Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 116, Interview with Sherilyn Kenyon. All right, let's get this party started.
Well, we finally made it happen, Sean.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. That seems like a pretty good career choice.
If you want to know how to be discovered in today's industry, then you need to talk with people who have actually been discovered in today's industry.
Doing this, we're going to be undercutting the noble calling of writer and generating instead pixel-stained techno-peasant wretches.
You should never start a creative endeavor that you're not a little bit worried this might be impossible.
You can be an ongoing source of inspiration and a continuing challenge.
And welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. My name is Sean.
This is Moses.
This is Brent.
And this episode is brought to you by Heart of the Ronin, a novel from Travis Heerman. You can listen to the novel at patiobooks.com, look it up in iTunes, or go to travisheerman.com to learn more about the novel and order a paperback copy. Heart of the Ronin by Travis Heerman. As I said, today we're joined by Sherilyn Kenyon, and we're also joined by Tobias Bakel, who returns for another segment of Ask a Writer, and we haven't had one of those, and I don't remember when. Originally, I was going to run it in the last show, but that was a long interview, Brent.
We had nobody complain about the length online, though. They wanted more ferret. I mean, how could you not want more ferret? Really?
Well, there was more, actually. I cut it down. I don't know if you noticed, but I cut like 7 or 8 minutes out of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, he and I spent probably 2 hours talking when we were talking. So you even got a condensed version.
Wow. You edited a lot out if it was that long.
Well, some of it was probably just he and I just catching up. So, okay. And in between when the microphone was on and we'd hit some strange tangent and decide to just keep talking. And I'm like, I can edit it out later.
No, it was a fun interview. There just certainly wasn't any room for an Ask a Writer segment after that. So we have it today. And then after that, we have a little bit of feedback to get to. But first, I thought we should talk about borders. It's certainly something everyone's talking about right now. And unless you're a little bit behind, you already know that Borders is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection and with a debt of $1.2 billion. There's an article from Locus Magazine or LocusMag.com, and we'll link to it in the show notes. But, I mean, if you just do a Google search for it, you'll find tons of articles about this. But some of their creditors include publishers like Penguin, who they owe $41 million to, and Hachette, they owe $36.9 million to them. Simon & Schuster, $33.75 million, and it goes on and on. They have received about $505 million in debtor-in-possession financing from GE Capital, so they'll be able to keep business going with that. But here's a great quote I wanted to read for you guys, and this is from their president, Mike Edwards, and he said, "It has become increasingly clear that in the light of the environment of curtailed," this is just so funny to me, "of curtailed customer spending and the company's lack of liquidity, Borders Group does not have the company resources it needs to be a viable competitor." Of course, there's a bunch of other things you can point to. But I think it's really funny the president talks about, well, customers aren't buying and we don't have any liquidity. And then my little addition here, because we went billions of dollars into unnecessary debt years ago that we didn't need to do. So once again, here's someone biting the dust for going deeply into debt when they shouldn't have. I know that's my personal aside, but if you want to grow that fast cash flow, some of it for Pete's sake.
Yeah, that article says they have a debt of $1.29 billion, but assets of $1.275 billion. So I just had to get out my calculator, figure this out. But I think that means they've got an actual debt of, you know, $15 million at this point, if you subtract their debt from what they say that are their assets.
But I assume that means they have to sell all their buildings.
Yeah, they had. I read that they're the 200 stores they're closing. Like they just now are in the process of closing 200 of their 642 stores, and those 200 stores, they're mainly the big mega stores. The ones that are closing are mainly the big ones. Those they're burning through about $2 million a week on money that they're losing on those stores. So they're, you know, going to save money, obviously, by hopefully getting rid of these. They may close another 75 stores, possibly in addition to these 200. And again, they have 642, so most of them are actually staying around. So if you're wondering what's going to happen to your Borders, you can go at this point and find out if your store is one of the 200 that's closing or not. You can call your Borders and find out. There's a good chance that it's not closing, and if it is closing, then, you know, that's not cool, obviously.
But I was actually surprised when I saw there were only 642 locations. I thought there'd be more than that. I guess it's just because they have tons of them in California.
Well, what's really sad about this, too, the numbers you threw out, Moses, are contingent on, in part, they're on the stores that they intend to have remain open. They're working to renegotiate their leases. In some of those cities, like I know one, and I think we mentioned it on a prior show, one in Kansas City that's near me has already closed. They're closing another in Kansas City that leaves a couple still open, but that's contingent on them renegotiating that space. And then you can find it, and we may put it may be worthwhile, Sean, to put a link in the show notes. Is there's been the list floating all over the interwebs of the 200 stores sort of that are closing, and I know people were tracking that this week. Writer friends in DC, the DC area, were lamenting the fact that all their stores were closing. Austin's the same case, so it's you know, it's sad to see some of those stores just completely closing down in some municipalities around this around the country.
That Locust Mag article lists five of the reasons why they're having these problems. If you're wondering why is Borders closing, and according to them, you know, some of the decisions that they've made, they sort of punted on online sales to Amazon, and they said, okay, we're not really focusing on that. Yeah, that didn't work out so well. Too much overseas expansion, it lists as one of the also issues they've had. Here's a nice one: an aggressive buyback of their stock. I looked, and in 2007, you could get Borders stock for about $25 a share. Right now, it's worth about 23 cents a share.
That's going the wrong way.
Yeah, about 1%.
I'm here to state the obvious.
Yeah, 1% of what it was 4 years ago. So that aggressive stock buyback, not such a great move in hindsight.
Okay, here's how much of an idiot I am. When I read that buying back of their stock, I thought they meant the books.
Oh.
I was like, the stock of actual product.
Yeah, I assume that means buying back their own stock.
I'm sure you're right.
And they also cite problems with long-term store leases. And the last issue is that basically they've had no answer to the e-readers. So whereas Barnes & Noble is doing okay now, and I think their stock has even come back some because they have a Nook product that's really nice. And actually, like, if I have a Kindle, but if I was going to buy a new e-reader today, I'd probably buy the Nook Color because it's got the color web browsing, you know, feature that's great, and the glare is not so bad on it. So Barnes & Noble has actually come up with a fantastic e-reader in that that Nook Color. And of course, Kindle is the biggest e-reader. But Borders, basically, they sell Kobo e-readers and Sony e-readers and I think one other one, but they didn't come up with their own. So that's a big issue going forward. It's a really big issue. And that's why I'm skeptical that they're going to be able to recover going forward, these other stores that they're not closing, because what are they going to do for the e-readers where so much of the commerce is going?
I remember the first time I went to Borders.com to try to order a book, and I looked at the page, and I'm like, why am I on Amazon? Did I come to Amazon.com? So I look at the URL bar, and it says, no, at Borders.com. And then you see this little icon. It says Borders by Amazon or whatever Amazon. It was. And I thought, well, that's stupid. Why wouldn't I just order it from Amazon? Because couldn't I get it cheaper if I just went through Amazon? I was so confused, and I never went back there again.
I had always wondered that when they were just rebranding the Amazon experience on how they just decided to punt their customers over to Amazon. That never seemed to make any sense to me. The other thing you hit on, Sean, was about the capital resources and the timing of everything, and even I think something Moses threw out, which is you've got their total debt, you had the buyback of stock, and then the curtailing customer spending. They obviously were investing, if you want to call it that, and dipping deep to invest in the growth of the company, and picked just about the worst time to do it without, as Moses pointed out, a good e-reader strategy. And I think that's ultimately what caught up with them. Mm-hmm. is that you probably had and even I think before 2008, when the market kind of collapsed, they were struggling. So that just doomed them. Is once the markets really went haywire, you know, October 2008, that just crippled them to kind of the point of no return. I'm honestly surprised that they lasted as long as they did without having to restructure significantly. I mean, that's the thing that just strikes me is they didn't have that e-strategy in place soon enough. And then yet at the same time, they were trying to grow their retail presence and digging deep to do it.
Speaking of the e-strategy, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but haven't there been some reports out that show that publisher profits are actually up because of e-books?
I'm not sure. I think that is true in some cases. In general, e-book sales keep going up and up, and, you know, paper sales keep going down and down. But I think you might be right.
Okay, because that would certainly just tie into the idea that they don't have their own ebook brand or their own ebook product. And I was just in my own Borders the other day, and you walk in there and they have this huge counter with six different ebooks on there. And it's really weird, and they range in price from all over the place, from like $70 to $300. It just didn't seem to make sense to me. I felt like I was in a Costco of ebook readers.
Yeah, and that's coming out of this, everything I've read, their focus is going to be on ebooks and on non-book items, which I'm a little ambivalent about the non-book items, although I do buy some greeting cards from Borders. I do like their selection of greeting cards, but I'm a little ambivalent, and they're funny magnets. They have some nice magnets, but I'm a little dubious of the non-book items.
Yeah, so yeah, the bookstore saving itself through everything but selling books. So sounds right.
Yeah. Sounds genius. Right, doesn't it?
Sounds like genius. The same people at Borders have been running things all along. Well, guys, if you could, to wrap up this, let's talk about what is one thing you would like to see Borders change moving forward? Just for your own personal taste.
Well, the one issue, I don't know about the change going forward. I'm still having a hard time chewing on what they've done to authors and the imprints.
Oh yeah, we haven't talked about that.
We haven't talked on that. And you know, going forward, what I'd like for them to do is to make sure that they do right by the authors and the imprints. You know, they're as of the time they filed, any shipments that took place after that, they're supposed to be paying everybody in full, but I've read some things. I've got the Wall Street Journal in front of me, and an analyst is reporting that authors and the imprints will be lucky to get back 25 cents on the dollar for the things that shipped prior. And that even includes, just so you're aware, and John Scalzi did a nice post on this, and he was very objective too, because he complimented Borders because they'd been good at stocking his book. But, you know, that included holiday sales. And I don't know about you, but I see an uptick in my own personal spending when it comes to book buying around holiday sales. So that to me is, you know, going forward, I want to make sure that they're doing right by authors and the imprints.
Yeah, I mean, have they shot themselves in the foot too much at this point, because the publishers have no trust in them anymore? I mean, what if Borders comes back to them and says, yeah, we're back in business, everything is great, and the publisher says, really, you know? I mean, this is trickling down to everyone in publishing. I mean, everyone at every level of the food chain is being hurt right now by what Borders is doing. So, you know, it may be a long shot for them to recover from this. I don't know. I mean, they're going to have a really great new strategy, and they're going to have to be a lot smarter about how they run their business. And a part of me, you know, ends up feeling like I almost wish that we could have at least one strong, you know, bookstore, and if it's Barnes & Noble, then it's Barnes & Noble. And I don't know. I'm kind of skeptical about Borders being able to recover, because the ebook thing is so fast. And once Amazon has their Kindle customers, Barnes & Noble has their Nook customers, how is Borders going to win over enough people to get a big enough share of that piece of the pie? And if they can't do that, I think they're in a lot of trouble.
I think it'd be horrible if there are authors out there who have been working for years and years and years to try to make it, and they're they're finally just starting to get it going. And if any of them were to be jeopardized or set back because of this, I think that'd be a real shame. I don't know if it would work that way or not. I just don't know enough about how the publishing business works on that retail end with the bookstore.
It's hurting all authors to some degree. You know, I mean, it's gonna be less money for anyone that's got books that are being sold through Borders, and Borders is one of the big places where books are sold.
Right.
So everyone is gonna make a little bit less money on that. One thing I wanted to mention before we're done, Dean Wesley Smith linked to a blog from C.E. Pettit, P-E-T-I-T, and his blog is called Scrivener's Error. The post is called Borders Refuses to Pay the Rent. That was on February 16th, and it's got a great rundown of how does this affect the customer? How does this affect the author? How does this affect, you know, everybody? And there's one line in it that I think is sad, but he says, "What does it mean to me as an author?" And the answer is that you're screwed, but you should be used to that by now.
I was going to say, yeah, because the writers are so rich already anyway.
Because, you know, not only is Borders screwing the authors, but their publishers could screw them too, because the publishers have to decide when are they going to pay them the royalties based on these books that may be sort of sold, and maybe they're going to get money. When do they get the money, and when are they going to want to hand over the checks? And so authors are used to being the last person in line when the money's handed out, and unfortunately this is making it worse.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Moses, because you brought up the whole notion of you've got Amazon with the Kindle, you've got Barnes & Noble with the Nook, and this is going to be a topic for another time, but things for the listeners and for us to noodle on. I would have said Apple potentially would have been your third competitor there, you know, because you always need at least three competitors, it seems like, in the marketplace. But, you know, with the publishing model that they just put out this week, and then Google came back up with their answer, you know, the landscape is certainly fraught with trials and tribulations, and it's almost like open warfare between all these entities trying to distribute content out into the marketplace.
There's a big one going on. I won't go into it, but between basically Apple, where they're saying that people that buy stuff through their apps, that Apple needs to get 30% of those sales. And that's going to be a really interesting battle between Barnes & Noble and Amazon are going to have that battle with Apple to figure out what are they going to do about that.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was referencing, because the next day Google came out and said, we'll only take 10%. And then, a topic for another time, we could certainly break this thing down as more information comes out.
Another topic for another time would be, I'm interested to see how many new independent bookstores are able to open and make it when their local Borders is out of the way, so to speak. I've read some reports saying that more independent bookstores are opening now than have in a long time. So that'd be something else to look into, because I think it would be a good thing to have more independent bookstores out there with that tailor to specific interests, like science fiction, fantasy, of course. But we should wrap this up. We'll talk about, we have some several topics here that we can discuss in future episodes. But for now, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with Sherilyn Kenyon and then Tobias Bakel after that. See you on the other side.
Hey there, listeners. Sean has been kind enough to offer me some time to tell you about my podcast novel, Heart of the Ronin. The reviews are in. Publishers Weekly says, the first volume of Heerman's Ronin trilogy is a page-turning folkloric narrative of epic proportions. His writing style is confident and fluid, his characters well-developed, and his serpentine storyline anything but predictable. Numerous tantalizingly unresolved plot threads will have readers anxiously awaiting the second installment in this gripping tale of ill-fated love, betrayal, and destiny. Pshaw. Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing calls it a solid, likable adventure story, sure to please fans of Japanese culture and fantasy readers alike. You're going to make me blush. FantasyBookCritic.com calls Heart of the Ronin a page-turner that you can't put down. It will leave readers begging for more. Highly recommended. Phew, my head explodeth. So you don't need to take my word for it. Check out the Heart of the Ronin podcast at PodioBooks.com or look for it in iTunes. Also available in all ebook formats and trade paperback from eReads. And now back to Sean and more adventures in sci-fi publishing.
This is Moses Sirigar with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Today I've got a wingman, a wingwoman.
You can call me wingman. It's okay.
Okay. This is Clancy Metzger. We're at the Superstars Writing Seminar in Salt Lake City, and we're here to interview Sherilyn Kenyon. Say hi.
Hello.
There's some really impressive things about Sherilyn. If you don't know her, she's got quite a story. She had 14 number one New York Times bestsellers in the course of about 2 years, just recently. You haven't had a release since August. It must be really strange.
It is. It's probably the longest stretch I've had in a while without a book out.
30 million-ish books in print and something like 60, over 60 bestsellers in her career. So kind of an impressive thing. Now, that's one way to introduce Sherilyn. Another way I want to introduce her is just to ask Clancy, what is the sound your daughter makes when she hears the name Sherilyn Kenyon?
Yeah, mention her name to my daughter, and it's something like a hyperventilating, something like that.
Yeah, I probably should have just gone with that, but that's all right. Clancy is going to help me interview you today. The way it's going to work is I'm going to ask the really dumb, generic guy questions, and she's going to ask the really smart, intelligence-specific questions to your career and your books, and I'm just kind of here to look pretty.
And you are pretty.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Clancy and I met at the first Superstars seminar. We both needed a roommate, so we kind of met up on the Facebook page, and it worked out great. She, you know, this beautiful woman swoops down in her sports car front. This is true.
I love her Mustang.
Yeah. Mustang. Swoops down, picks me up. She drives down from the big city, Salt Lake, and picks me up in Arizona, drives me to L.A., you know, takes me to Hollywood. You know, we met, like, Batwoman. I mean, that was, like, in front of Grauman's Theater, so
yeah.
It was probably, like, a starving actress, but...
it was pretty cool still.
So, anyway, she's a good friend, and now we're in Clancy's hometown, and what did Kevin tell you?
Kevin J. Anderson said they had to move the seminar to Salt Lake City so that I didn't have to drive across the country with a strange man.
Right. That's me.
Yeah. But I want to say kudos to Moses's wife, because how many women are going to just let their husband drive across the country and share a hotel room with a woman they've never met?
That's true.
Yeah, she rejected all my advances. Totally bombed on that level, but no, I'm extremely married, but... So let me get back to Sherilyn and ask you, this is Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing is the name of our podcast. So I got to ask you some dumb guy questions like, okay, paranormal romance, what the heck is going on here? Why is this taking off? I know you've been asked this 100 times, but like, you know, explain it to the guys in the audience. Why is this such a popular genre?
It's sexy. Vampires, creatures of the night, demons, werewolves, shapeshifters. They're dark, they're dangerous, they're hunky, they're alpha. Women love them. That's it.
I'll buy that. That makes sense. Speaking of hot, so just so you can visualize Sherilyn, you know, imagine a very distinguished professional author, woman, someone who looks like she sells millions of books, and then she's also, like yesterday, you were dressed all in black, so you're kind of like like the goth fantasy chick also. So just, I want the guys in the audience to get a little visual of Sherilyn here so you know who
my
you're...
My sons are cringing. All their teenage boys are like, no, my mom's like, ah, goth, my mother, no. What happened to the nose ring? My son was in, I think, fourth or fifth grade, and I went to pick him up from a book signing. I wasn't thinking. I had the nose ring still in, and he's like, Mom, Mom, and he's pointing to my nose. I'm like, what, a booger? And then he's like, take that out. Oh, my God, I'm so embarrassed. All right, fine. My kids are no fun.
Okay, 14 number one New York Times bestsellers in the course of a couple of years, 60 best-selling novels. So how do you do that?
Fans. I have awesome fans. God bless every one of them. I truly don't know. You know, it's one of those things because my career early on tanked, and it's the same books I'm writing now. It took me 10 years to sell a Dark Hunter book because back in the day, nobody would touch a vampire novel, which now if you can say that magic vamp word, you're in like Flynn. But, you know, back in the day, it was a hard sell, so I have no idea.
My friend Laura Resnick, she had a urban fantasy that she couldn't sell, held on to it for forever, and now she sold it in recent years, and it's like her best-selling book ever. So that was kind of an interesting lesson that you got to sometimes hold on to your books until they come in vogue, and then they'll take off.
Sometimes it's just timing and dumb luck or fortuitous luck or whatever.
Well, in my case, what happened was my publisher lost a bid on another author. And when they couldn't get that person, my agent swooped in like a vulture and said, I have somebody who writes similar with a lot of humor, too. And at that time, and it's interesting because the editor who bought me had rejected the same book 3-4 times previously. But she had recently married a man who was Greek, and the hero is an ancient Greek general. So suddenly she had this affinity for Greek people, and there you go, timing.
Wow. All right, but how about the 14 in 2 years part? Like, that doesn't happen normally. So.
Me and Patterson. Yay, Patterson. it's the fans. That is totally fan-driven. Like, they first day they turn out, I love you guys so much. Thank you.
So what does your writing schedule look like to pull that off?
Well, actually, I'm nocturnal, which is part of the problem with traveling. I don't go to bed till dawn normally. So, and I sleep till about, I try to sleep till 10. Usually I get up between 8 and 9. Thank God my husband gets my kids off to school because they get up about the time I'm going to bed. I make them breakfast before I go to sleep. And I have a really turnaround. I do my best writing about 10 o'clock. Used to be the kids are in sleep. Now that they're teenagers, they're kind of, you can hear them upstairs, dun, 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 dun. You know, and I know they're not going to bed till 2 or 3, even though they've got to get up at 5. But whatever. I'm that kind of parent. I know where they are. I usually do the bulk of my writing between 10 and 6. So, and the rest of the day I do with the other stuff that writers have to do, cover approval, copy approval, reading, reviewing other books and things like that.
So eight hours a day is a normal writing day for you?
20.
Of actual writing?
Not of actual, of attempting to write.
Right. I know that goes.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's 20 hours a day, 7 days a week.
But from 10 to 6, is that, were you saying that's your main writing time?
That's the bulk of it. I do get a couple of pages done during the day, but really it's so chaotic. The phone's always ringing. Yeah, I write for 5 of the major 6 publishers. So somebody's always calling me with something. You know, the kids are, Mom, I'm sick. I need you to come pick me up. Those kind of things.
And you sleep 4 hours a day?
Yeah, on average.
So it's pretty easy what you do then.
What, the 4 hours? No, I'm really a crack. See, I take it out on my children. My fans never get it. Yeah.
All right, let Clancy ask you something smart and intelligent and specific.
Okay, now I feel bad about calling at 8 a.m. this morning. Really bad.
It's okay.
Okay, so I wanted to ask about, last night at dinner, you were talking about how Plato inspired you, and I thought it was really interesting how you incorporate that into your writing about leaving enough for every reader to personalize it. Can you explain that?
Sure. Plato's theory of aesthetics, it talks about how everybody has like the perfect image of whatever object, whether it's a chair or a comb or, you know, food, whatever. And what I like to do with my writing is I like to describe it just enough to where your own imagination will fill in all the details so that you personalize each and every book to what you like. And I'm not intruding on your imagination, because to me as a writer, the most important thing you'll ever have is that reader's imagination and what they see. And if you really want to tap into their imagination, their emotions. And so you work with generals with just enough details to where they can, you know, if it's a solitary chair, a solitary cabin. It's very different than, you know, some people picture a cabin as one room out in the woods. Some people, when I say the word cabin, they're like, oh, you mean my 16-bedroom house up in the hills, you know.
What kind of feedback do you get? I mean, obviously, when you've got 30 million books in print, you'll find someone who hates everything eventually, probably. I mean, someone's going to criticize everything. But as far as the way you write description like that, do people tend to, in their reviews, do they tend to praise your description? Do they complain? Do they say, oh, I could see it? Or
the consensus is that they and it fascinates me, because when I look at it, I don't see that many details in it. I think I'm a very bare writer, but they always comment on, oh, my God, her details are just so descriptive, and I see it so clearly. I'm like, good, that's what I'm going for.
Okay, so maybe that really is everybody doing exactly what you want them to do. They're visualizing it so in detail because you have left it to their imagination to fill it in. And so maybe that's why they relate so well. Because you can. You feel everything. You really do.
That's what I'm struggling to do every time. Yay. It worked. Yay.
So does that surprise you a little bit when they say that? Because
it does at times. Because like I said, to me, when I read over it, I have to force myself sometimes to go fill in extra details. But yeah, it is surprising. But I'm grateful.
Yeah, I have a little taste of that. People said things about, you know, what I've written that I didn't even think were strengths, and then they didn't praise the things that I thought were strengths. Mm-hmm. So apparently you have no idea about your own writing. But, you want to ask something else, Clancy?
I do. Last night, again, at dinner, we were talking about sympathetic or unsympathetic characters, and a lot of your heroes started out in previous books very unsympathetic. And then in their own books, we got enough history or whatever that made them sympathetic, and now they were heroic to us. And that you were still trying to figure out Styx, I think, that even you aren't sympathetic to him, and so you haven't been able to write that character, you know, his book yet. But when you go into it, do you have their history in mind so it's like, I know they're unsympathetic or they appear unsympathetic right now, but I know when their book comes out, they will be, because I know why they're like this. Or does it come to you later?
I always know the characters, including Styx. And there's a part of me that is very sympathetic to Styx, but at the same time, he's such a brat that in my mind, I'm not ready to redeem him yet. I'm still so angry at him. It'll be a while coming. But with whether it's Valerius or it's Zarek, in those cases, I knew exactly. People are deep. You know, I come from a less than happy background. And you can't look at, my mother always had a saying, I'm 3/4 Cherokee. And my mother always had a saying that you don't know, and it's the old saying, you don't know someone till you walk a mile in their moccasins. And it's very true. And with the characters, to me, they're so real that I don't even think of them like characters. I think of them like people that I'm meeting. And what I like to do with the readers is you see that one side of them, such as Nicolette Peltier, who runs Sanctuary. People saw her as the loving mother. Then we get to Wren's book, and they're like, that's not her. No, you're now seeing the character through somebody who despises her. Up until now, you've seen her through the eyes of her children. You've seen her through the eyes of Vane. And these are people she has a very loving relationship, people that she's nurtured. But Wren, you have personality conflicts. No matter how nice you are, there is, like you were saying, there is somebody who is going to hate your guts for whatever reason. It could be the color of shoes you're wearing. And so I bring that into the books, and I think that it's what makes the characters seem more real to the people who are reading them, because they are real people. You have people you get along with, people you despise, and, you know, in terms of, I think that everybody, no matter how mean they are, there is something that nobody is born evil. Well, my grandmother notwithstanding, nobody is born evil. You know, but I spent a lot of times, because my grandmother was if ever there was a soulless human being born, it truly was the woman who raised me. And I've always wondered what made her that way. And I never could break through, because she never would talk about her past, which in and of itself I think is very telling. So with the characters, I do the same thing. What made you that way?
That's fascinating. So, Sherilyn, 2 R's and 1 N, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sherilyn Kenyon, K-E-N.
Unless they change it again. It's been wrong on books before.
Okay. K-E-N-Y-O-N, Kenyon. And is your website sherilynkenyon.com?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you give us like the equivalent of the elevator pitch for like first book in your series, or, you know, what's the summary of, you know, your series or one of the early ones like that?
They're mad, bad, and immortal. The thing that I do that's a little different from most vampires is generally vampires are immortal from the get-go. In the case of mine, they ticked off the god Apollo by murdering his mistress and his son. So mine only lived 27 years, because that was the age she was when they killed her. And the only way they can live past the age of 27 is to take human souls into them. And that's the basis of the whole series. The Dark Hunters were created by the goddess Artemis to protect mankind, kind of. Actually, it was more to control Asheron, but that's a whole other discussion.
Because she's not real sympathetic. Yeah, Artemis is not real sympathetic.
See, now I want to write hers because she is sympathetic. Y'all just don't understand.
We don't get it yet. That's it, yeah. We don't see her yet.
Is that a point of view thing again, that we're only seeing Artemis from people who don't like her?
Yeah. So although there's a whole bunch of Artie supporters who are out there, and I think it's hilarious that they side with me, but they're almost afraid. One, Marie always comes dressed as Artemis, and when she walks through book signing crowds, I have a great photo on the website of one of the girls who was dressed as Simmy trying to eat her with barbecue sauce. It's hilarious.
Nice.
You brought up the Greek gods. Clancy was telling me about your book series. And, you know, as a guy who's not used to reading in the genre, I was like, okay, vampires, okay, demons, okay, you know. And then she said, you know, Greek gods. And I said, oh, ooh, Greek gods? Wait, what's that? So how did they get into your books? And why, you know, what's in your background that made you put Greek gods into your books?
I was a freaky little kid who was mocked for carrying mythology books around when she was... I taught myself Greek so I could read the Iliad and Odyssey. I am just that nerdy. I always loved, you know, again, because of the Cherokee heritage, you know, my grandfather was a rainmaker. So I was raised around a lot of spiritual, natural kind of magic things that a lot of people don't see. And I was always fascinated because mythology is religion. And when I was in college, I cannot emphasize enough, I was raised real poor. We ascribed when I was little, my biggest dream was to have a double wide, and I wish I were joking. Anybody who hey, double wides are nice.
I'd like trailers.
For those people out there, let me tell you, double wides are nice, you know. Trailers are nice. That would have been a big step up from where I was raised. So anyhow, yeah, I always don't be offended, please. I'm not trying to offend anybody. But anyhow, so when I was in college, the only way I could get through college was to work three jobs. One of the jobs that I had was working as an editor for a small science fiction magazine, which anybody who knows, you know, you have a publication subscription rate of 5. I am exaggerating. Mike knows this. He's like, hey, wait, we had, you know, 50. We had a tiny subscription rate, and my boss was like, wouldn't it be nice if we could get it up to maybe one day we could afford the ink? I'm like, yeah, Mike, wouldn't it be great if one day you could get it up to where you could afford to pay, I don't know, me? And he said, well, come up with a serial thing that we can addict people to. I'm like, okay, great. Can I do vampires? And he looks at me going, we're science fiction. Yeah, I know. Can I do vampires? Yeah, okay, we're science fiction fantasy now. Go do a vampire for me. And ironically, I started doing vampire stories before I could even write words. I did them as a cartoon when my mother was pregnant with my little brother. And she was convinced, oh, my God, I'm going to die in childbirth because my daughter keeps bringing me these people sucking necks in a cemetery. What have I done? I went, Mother, you took this little girl at 3 years old. You smuggled her in a trunk to see Night of the Living Dead. What do you expect? Love my mother. She's a huge horror fan. Anyway, I went to see The Exorcist when I was, you know, third grade. At that time, adults were being hauled out on stretchers. And I can still remember the guy going, lady, you want to take a baby into this movie without your mind? And my mother's looking at the guy dead serious going, you don't understand. I can't watch it without her. I need her to tell me when I can look. So, I have no concept of horror or gore, obviously. My mother was the scariest thing. Tiny little woman looked like Jackie Onassis, always dressed in pink. The most elegant little woman. Mean. My daddy used to do, honey, I did 3 tours of duty in Vietnam. Scariest thing I ever saw is your mama when she's mad. But yeah, I diverged. So I'm sitting there. I'm doing my 3 jobs. I get to my next one, which was working for a local paper, and it was Halloween time. So we're doing a series of articles on the origins of different Halloween legends, one of them being vampires and werewolves. And my independent search kept going back to ancient Greece, everything that I always read, the earliest legends out there. And I was talking to one of my college professors. I'm like, you know, so much has been done with the Egyptians. It's been done with Lilith and all these other stories that are out there. Why has nobody ever taken it back to Apollo? He's Greek god of not only the sun, but he's Greek god of plagues. I mean, if ever there was somebody to tick off, this is the man to start a vampire legend. And the minute that came out, my brain went, oh, hello. Maybe you should do this. And I went back and started the first of the Dark Hunter stories.
I'm nodding my head because the start of my book, I have a chapter called A Sacrifice to Apollo, and there's a chapter called, you know, basically about why people... It's like symbolic of the beginning of the Iliad where people offended Apollo and there's a plague, and I love that stuff. So I'm going to let Clancy ask some more fangirl questions. What else do you have here?
All right. I want to know, who's your favorite character? I have a suspicion, I know, but I'm going to ask anyways. Who's your favorite character and why?
My odds are, I'm going to take the field. I'm going to take whatever the opposite of what she's taken.
It's like asking me to pick between my kids. I love them all. I really do. And people look at you, no, you can't. No, you're right. At times I want to kill them all. I have thought of murdering every character in every series. But at the end of the day, if I don't love them, I'd kill them off. So they are all my favorites. And You know, some of them have been with me longer, like Nikirian from the lead series started out as my childhood playmate, which is weird because he's an assassin. It says a lot about my childhood.
We got to do another podcast about your childhood.
Okay, but still, there's surely one that just is sort of, you just are very fond of, that just brings us, I mean, I know, I love both my kids, but I love them differently.
Yeah.
Clancy doesn't want to lose this bet.
No.
I'm winning right now.
I just want to know. I think there's probably one that, maybe one you relate to more.
No, but it's weird. I've got a wall up. There are parts of me, like Simi dresses like me, or like I used to till my children started protesting. At my age, short skirts just don't really look good, especially not with platforms, although I'm still willing to go for the look. But, you know, I don't want to scar my children too much. Yeah. But, no, I mean, you know, there are things that, like, Bubba always makes me laugh. Anytime Bubba comes on the stage, I mean, come on, he owns a computer and a gun store. What is not to make you laugh about that? Any man whose motto in life is, hey, y'all, you got computer problems? Call 1-800, call Bubba. If I can't take care of your troubles one way, I'll take care of them another. I mean, you got to love him. But, yeah, and I love Simi's little joie de vivre where everything can be cured with barbecue sauce and flames.
Yeah. I'm kind of a sucker for the southern stuff. I grew up in, like, the suburbs around Atlanta, even though I was born in New Jersey. So I'm kind of a transplant. But
what
still,
part?
I grew up in mainly in Lilburn, which is close to Stone Mountain.
Oh, well, honey, I know. Riverdale, baby.
Oh, okay.
Cherokee County and Riverdale, yeah.
Yeah, I remember playing a football team from Riverdale, I think.
My cousin.
My Pop Warner League, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, I had one of my good friends was in Toccoa, Georgia, northeast Georgia, closer to South Carolina, and they had a double wide, and it was just his dad and him and his brother. We're all, you know, I was friends with him and his brother, and I love that double wide, man.
Oh, yeah, they're nice. People do not realize how beautiful they are.
Yeah. I lived in a double wide once. I did. It was decent.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. So now I got to ask you, how does growing up in the South, you know, I obviously hear it in your voice and hear you talking about it, but how do you think that shaped your writing or?
What is it? What's her name? Florence King once said, if you were to put up a fence around the South, you'd have the world's biggest mental asylum. Yeah, I love Southerners. Again, not to offend anybody. Southerners are great storytellers. If you ever doubt me, ask somebody for directions. Because you don't get, you know, go 1.5 miles, turn right. No. You go, now you need to go down the street a little ways. You remember old Miller Barn? Do you remember old Miller? Now, that was a character. I loved him. Do you remember that time the chicken got out and he shot the bull? I love Southerners. Everything about the culture. It's just, you know, they're insane. You got to love them.
My favorite bumper sticker I saw last time I was in Nashville was on a pickup truck, and it said, we don't care how y'all did it up north. You know, they got all the transplants down there. And I explain that to people when they think about moving to Nashville. It's like, yeah, there's that, you know, and then there's, you know, the people from the Northeast. And they call them halfbacks. They move to Florida. And then they get halfway back. They get up to Asheville. They get halfway back to the Northeast. I guess we could probably wrap up, unless you want to ask anything else, Clancy.
No,
anything?
I'm good.
No? Okay. Well, it's been a lot of fun to talk to you. Thanks for sitting with us. And we'll look forward to checking out what you're up to.
Thank you.
This is Lou Anders, Editorial Director of Pyre Books, and you are listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
And now it's time for Ask a Writer with Tobias S. Buckel.
Hi, this is Tobias Buckel for Ask a Writer. Today I have a question that is from Dale, which says, when writing science fiction or fantasy, I sometimes want to say something like a rock the size of a beach ball, or a creature similar in size and shape to a Great Dane, or as wriggly as an eel. However, I feel uneasy about comparisons with contemporary Earth objects since, for example, my current protagonist is an alien girl in a pre-industrial alien society. Since my viewpoint is close to third person and she wouldn't know what a beach ball is, it seems a bit jarring to make such comparisons. On the other hand, saying something like, it rolled across the ground like a gibbering fibblefish on a dapper stock, and leaving it up to the reader to guess what the hell that means, doesn't particularly seem the right way to go either. So my question is, how can you deal with metaphors and similes in fantastical worlds in a transparent, seamless way? Well, Dale, that is something of a million-dollar question and strikes at the heart of the craft, certainly, and one of the interesting problems that we as science fiction writers in particular have that some other genres don't. It occurs to me that what you need to do is sort of split the difference. You need to find things that are recognizable to the readers, recognizable to you, that your alien or fantastical character has in common. For example, the size of a head. Your head is roughly the size of a very small beach ball. So you would then use that as a springboard for a reference to other objects. The size of a fist could be used to compare the size of, say, an alien fruit. You know, as wide across as someone is tall. So what you need to do is you need to, in the first several chapters or the first opening segments of the short story, is you need to use frames of reference that are recognizable like that. And starting from a body or a fist or things like that are certainly a way for you to begin creating size descriptions that would make sense to a reader. The goal is to start out by using those size or descriptions that we have in common and compare them to other things, and then you can then sort of bridge the gap and compare other things to those new things that have been introduced. So what you want to do is start out saying it's a rock the size of, you know, someone's head, and work your way through until by the end of the short story you're saying it, you know, it rolls across the ground like a gibbering fibble fish on a dapper stock, and your readers will know exactly what you mean because you spent a lot of time talking about the fact that, you know, a flibble fish looks like, you know, something else that we might have in common. It looks like a hand-shaped, you know, fish, and you can go from there. It's tricky, and it requires you to often maybe beta test your manuscripts with other readers and some first readers to make sure you're getting it right, and you have to experiment a lot. You know, sometimes it can go off too far, and you know, sometimes just some of the fun of science fiction and fantasy is to give a sentence like it rolled across the ground like a gibbering flibble fish on a dapper stalk, and go ahead and just let the reader sort of roll into it. You know, one of my favorite poems in the world is The Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll, and it is full of, you know, apparently nonsense words that have no relation to existing ones in our world, and yet by the end of the poem you have a sense for what's going on and what's happening, even though it does seem to be at first glance all nonsense. And I think when you look at a poem like, you know, Jabberwocky, you can kind of get a sense for the fact that you can go ahead and write something that has a lot of strange alien words and alien names and still kind of create a narrative that a reader can enjoy. It's a lot harder to do it. It's a lot harder to jabberwocky your way around a story. It's a lot easier to sort of bridge it, I think, and your readers will be more happy with that. But in and of itself, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to go to pull a Jabberwocky, which is what I'm going to call it from now on. I don't think it's inherently a bad thing, as long as you spend a lot of time doing your best to make sure that there's an internal logic that your readers can pick up on, and that there are lots of clues as to what's going on so that readers can puzzle their way through it. Because that's part of the fun, puzzling your way through it and figuring out what's going on in some cases. If you're not committed to jabberwockying your way through it, then you really do need to look for common frames of reference and work on putting those in ahead of time so that you can slowly bridge your way down through things. You know, you're going to assume that, you know, maybe we all see the same colors. So, you know, describing things in terms of colors is going to be something that's important. We have similar movements. There are shapes that are all similar. And because you have a character that is a creature of some sort, then that creature becomes a frame of reference. The point of view character is a size frame of reference that you can start using to then build on the story and how everything that that person perceives is related to sizes. Because ultimately, as human beings, we do that anyway. We walk around our environment and things are bigger than us or smaller than us, and multiples of bigger than us or smaller than us. And that's a way for you to start using scales and reference scales to introduce readers to what's going on in your story. So that's my advice, and I think that's one way you can get around it. You've got lots of different options there, but ultimately it's all about what serves the story and how you think it's working. Tune in next time when I answer another question. And I just have to say, it's nice to be back after a long absence of Ask a Writer. So send in your questions.
And we're back. Thank you, Sherilyn, for coming on the show. And thank you, Toby, for another segment of Ask a Writer. If you have a question that you would like addressed by Toby, please email it to us, adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com, and we will forward it on so you can have your question answered on the show. But now it's feedback time.
We have an email from Doug who says, good discussion on episode 15's podcast about Heinlein's Rule 3, but there's another justification that may have been overlooked. By refraining from rewriting, one also leaves aside less accomplished earlier work in order to practice anew on fresh material. It's not clear whether a beginning writer is better served by reworking flawed pieces or letting the older pieces lie and moving on to pieces that might be more accomplished and therefore promising from the start. I suspect it's simply better practice to keep writing new and fresh rather than to polish rocks. A more experienced writer should be better able to fix up a piece into presentable form with a rewrite or two, after which it's not clear that anything much is served by going farther. But at any rate, I suspect Heinlein's rules are more intended for the beginning writer than for one who knows the ropes. The latter should know enough to get by with their own internally generated rule set. Thoughts, gentlemen?
So my thought is, now I'm coming at this from the point of view of me. Of course, it's everything is filtered through the point of view of you. And for me, as a new writer, I did rework flawed pieces. So I think this comes back to everyone is different, and that's always the rule. You know, in my case, like, I feel like I had so many ideas that went into my first novel that I had been sort of brewing on in my subconscious for my whole life, practically. And to just abandon that piece and go on to something new, I think for me would have been a huge mistake, because there's so much cool stuff that, you know, I wanted to put into this book, and it's like so much in there. So, yeah, it's different for everyone. As far as I'm concerned, if it takes the same amount of time to write a whole new story as it does to rewrite a whole story. I mean, I wrote a whole first draft and then rewrote the entire book. You know, whatever you think sounds right to you. I mean, if the first thing you write is not going to be publishable anyway, so if the next thing is, you're still going to have one thing by the time you're done with it, if it's any good.
I agree and disagree. So I agree with both of you guys, because I think the idea behind that rule is what Robert J. Sawyer said, and we had a comment on the blog post about this, which is you cannot keep rewriting the same thing over and over and over and over and over, and in doing so, convince yourself that you're a writer. You know, you have to write new stuff. And I think it was in Ferret's interview, right, that he said that, you know, when he has a breakthrough, it's not until two or three stories later that there's a payoff from that breakthrough, that he often doesn't achieve that breakthrough in the rewrite when he realizes, oh my gosh, I needed to deepen this or go here with that. Rewriting is an art in itself too. And I remember hearing the phrase a lot, writing is rewriting, when I was taking writing courses in college. And I think, but it was the same way as writing new material. The only way you're going to learn how to become a talented rewriter and to fix mistakes is if you practice rewriting and fixing mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, I think we agreed, the three of us, we don't ascribe particularly to Heinlein's Rule 3, and we're not down on it. But, you know, I'm very much a rewriter, and sounds like you two guys are too, right?
I'll run the gamut. I'll rewrite material. I've abandoned projects, but that's a matter of prioritization in favor of other projects that I'm more enamored with. And, you know, this whole topic, I think that's what it really gets down to. I had the pleasure of meeting Michael Swanwick earlier in the year before we were doing the podcast. And, you know, he felt like he only had so many great ideas that he could address through story. And this is a conversation we had, because I, you know, was kind of coming from the Merle Lafferty camp of ideas are free. What are you talking about? And he said, well, yeah, you can come up with any old idea, but I could see him looking at this and saying, if you're really enamored with an idea, I'm going to rewrite the heck out of that story or toss the original story entirely, which I've done and written just from scratch, to go back and cover that idea again. Now, you may end up with a new story, but to me, that's still rewriting. If I've dumped a story and taken the same kind of principal idea and then gone on and created a new story out of it, to me, that's rewriting. If I look at it from that sense, you know, I would rewrite, but I've also abandoned stories too and just moved on. And that's just a, you know, a kind of economy of my own time. Now, I may pick those back up 10 years from now. Who knows? But I can kind of see both sides. But it just, to me, it just depends on where you are and kind of your philosophy on whether you think every idea of yours is brilliant or if you're kind of in the Nancy Kress, or because Nancy Kress has mentioned that to me as well, as she's like, I only have so many good ideas, or whether you really kind of throw away your ideas before the editor even sees them.
Do you guys ever have the experience where you have an idea and you live with it for a while, then after a while it just doesn't seem cool anymore? And is it that because it's not a cool idea, or just because it's been in your head too long that it lost that initial excitement?
Yeah, I've looked at that a little bit. I think that can happen to you, definitely. Maybe you just lost the spark. You know, you should have written it when you got the idea, and you let it sit for too long, and your muse moves on to something else.
I honestly see that as a sign it's ready for me to submit it and get on with my next story. Because I've done that with a few. Matter of fact, one of my writers of the future honorable mention stories was a story that was like that. I was so sick and tired of the story, and the idea just felt so worn to me at that point. I'm like, I need to get this thing out because I'm done with it. I'm just done with this story.
Yeah, I was thinking of like an idea where you don't even write the story.
Write the story.
You've just got the idea in the back of your head somewhere that, ooh, maybe I'll write this someday. And I don't know if that's what you're referring to, Sean.
Yeah, I've actually had both that and what Brent's talking about, the short story that I'm just finishing the final rewrite on, and I will never rewrite ever again, so help me God. I am so sick of it. And as actually one, as the story that you read, Brent, and you gave me some really good feedback on. But I've been working on that thing on and off for like 6 months. So I'm ready to burn it. Mm-hmm. So when I look
means
at,
it's ready to submit. Submit yeah. it now.
Yeah. I'm going to. But that makes me look at Doug's email and be like, yeah, you're right. I mean, I hope it's a good story now. But could I have written four or five other stories in that same amount of time? And would that be better? I don't know. Like if it wins Writers of the Future, then I'm sticking to rewriting.
Yeah. Laura Resnick told me something brilliant. Now she's not a Rule 3 person like me. You know, we rewrite, but she told me basically, like, I'm paraphrasing here, that when it comes to any kind of fiction, someone is going to have to work hard on it. It's either going to be the reader, if the author didn't work hard enough on it the first time, or it's going to be the author who works hard enough on it that the reader can just read it and get right through it and not have a hard time figuring everything out. So I'm kind of with her on that one. I'd rather be the one doing the hard work and making it easy on the reader instead of just kind of, you know, rushing something and, you know, making it hard for someone else to figure out what's going on in my story.
Someone should have told that to William Faulkner. Sorry.
You still having a bad case of Absalom jitters over there?
Oh, I did read that one. How did you know? I actually liked it quite a bit, but the reader has to work, no doubt about it.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Well, thank you for the email, Doug. It's a great topic. And if you want to participate more on that topic, come to the blog post for episode 115. There's some comments left on there, and we'd love to have your feedback on that. You know, lastly, before we sign off, a quick reminder to join us on Twitter and Facebook. You can do that by coming to adventuresinscifipublishing.com and just clicking on the links on the right side of the homepage. And thank you to Alias Kiss and Silly Sage for the new iTunes reviews, which we asked for, I think it was the last show. Thank you very much, both of you. And if you use iTunes, please write us a review for the podcast. It certainly helps, and we really appreciate it. And I'm having some issues with the feed there. I don't think anyone is incapable of downloading, but I cannot for the life of me get the new artwork to show. So if you have any issues with the feed over the next week or two, know that I'm working on it. And trying to get that fixed. So just be patient with me. But feel free to send me an email if a couple days go by and you can't download something. I may have like really screwed something up. Just want to get that warning out there. Not that anyone will be able to download this and hear that warning. On the website, we also have some new articles and videos from our newest contributor, DT. He interviewed Lane Diamond, who is a freelance editor. It's a very cool interview. Check it out. And he also has a piece on forthcoming novels from Patrick Rothfuss and Kevin J. Anderson. Guys, did we miss anything?
I miss you guys.
Oh, you're so emotional today, Moses.
I've actually never met Sean, so I really miss him.
But Moses, put down the pen. 3,000 words a day is getting to you, brother.
I'm going to take that as a no that we got everything in. Oh, there is a new video, a really cool. Did you guys see the trailer for the new Ray Gun revival?
No. I saw the video, but I didn't watch it yet.
Yeah, I saw the artwork as well. Yeah. I hadn't had a chance to look at it.
My only fiction sale ever was to them when they were first getting started a couple years ago. And they have a really nice looking magazine that they do, but it's a great little video. So come to the homepage and watch it. I got a kick out of it. It was very well done. But you know what? I guess that's it for now. We will be back again soon. Keep coming to the website. We have new articles and book reviews going up all the time. Gentlemen, thank you very much. And everyone, thanks for listening.
We miss you.
Take care.
Oh, boy. Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Please visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com for show notes, book reviews, film reviews, videos, coverage of live events, and so much more. You can leave us feedback at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com or call the voicemail line at 206-350-5029. All contact information can be found on the About Us page on the website. Until next time, keep reading.